everyone, this is Mireille Gino, and you're listening to the New Books in African Studies podcast. Joining me today is Professor Chike Jeffers, currently an assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Professor Jeffers is the editor of Listening to Ourselves, a Multilingual Anthology of African Philosophy, published by SUNY Press. Professor Jeffers, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Mireille.
Well, I wonder if you'd begin by telling us a little bit about yourself, and this can be anything from your educational background to how you came to this project.
Okay, sure. Well, I'm from Toronto, Toronto, Ontario, Canada. I'm the son of Caribbean immigrants. My father is from Dominica, and my mother is from Guyana. And I grew up in Toronto and went to York University, which is in Toronto, for my education, where I started off in film, actually, but along the way realized that I was headed more towards the academic side of things. So I switched at one point from film production to film studies and took on philosophy as a minor. But as soon as I had a year of taking philosophy courses, I realized that, that's what I would like to do with life. So that's how I ended up choosing to go to graduate school in philosophy. I did my PhD at Northwestern University in the Chicago area, which was a great place for me in a lot of ways, relevant to this book. Northwestern has a strong tradition in African studies and one of the best African studies libraries that's out there. And while I was there, I was also studying with Souleymane Bachir Janya, a Senegalese philosopher who's currently at Columbia. But he's a mentor of mine, and he's also one of the people in the book. So actually the first chapter is by him and is in Wolof. After receiving my PhD, or rather shortly before receiving my PhD, I got a job at Dalhousie University, which is here in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. And I'm also happy to report that I'm no longer assistant professor. I am currently associate professor. I received tenure and promotion earlier this year. So here I am, and I'm happy for how this book, Listening to Ourselves, a Multilingual Anthology, was one of the things that I could present when I went up.
Well, that's fantastic. So congratulations on that. That's very, very exciting development. I think I should also, before we get too far, also say that I think all the best moms come from Guyana. So I'm glad that you mentioned that, in case anybody might be listening. So that's really interesting. You know, the trajectory, both the film studies and sort of this developing interest in philosophy, and then winding up at Northwestern, which, as you say, is probably one of the best places you could end up if you're doing African studies of any strain. The book, and I don't know if you want to sort of talk in more detail about how the actual project came about. You do detail that a bit in your introduction, but if you could say a little bit more maybe about the evolution of the project.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The introduction does say quite a bit about the motivation for the project, although also I do say a bit about kind of just how it came about initially in my acknowledgments, because I was, I think, in my first year, yes, I would have been in my first year of graduate school, my first year at Northwestern. I started in 2004, but I think that the events here would have taken place in 2005. I had the idea for the anthology, and that would have just come about partly because of the kinds of things I would have been reading. I think by now, by that time, I would have read some Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, who was kind enough to do a foreword for the book, as we may also discuss later. But I've been reading him, and I always have had a strong interest in language and languages. I think in another life I could have been a linguist, but I probably also always would have had my philosophical inclinations as well. But so I actually, one thing I can even also say about my background that would have helped to lead to this project is that growing up in Toronto, I attended a Saturday program called the African Canadian, it was called the Black Heritage Program when I was first in it, but it was renamed eventually the African Canadian Heritage Association. And one of the things that they used to do when I was small is that they would have someone teach Swahili. So as a child, I was learning some Swahili. I learned how to count. I learned how to say, my name is, and so on and so on. It was not the kind of thing where they managed to bring us all the way to, say, conversational fluency. But even that was an early kind of, I would say, influence leading up to a project like this. A strong interest in languages in general, and African languages in particular, as this important part of the cultural heritage of African people. So especially having by that time in grad school read some Ngugi Wa Thiong'o and his thoughts on the importance of writing in African languages, and having by that time read some work in African philosophy, such as by Kwasi Wiredu, a Ghanaian philosopher who's also in the book, and some of the discussions that he had about the use of African languages. Someone who's not in the book is a man named Samuel Imbo, IMBO, and he has an introduction to African philosophy where that's one of the questions that he raises, the question of whether African philosophy should be written in African languages. And so I started to feel like it was, an interesting question that many African philosophers were asking. And it just seemed to me that there was the need to move from talk to action. There was the need to actually start doing more philosophy in African languages. And so I was at a meeting of the American Philosophical Association, the Central Division, which often ends up in Chicago, where I was, and I was talking with Emmanuel Eze. Emmanuel Chukwudi Eze was a Nigerian philosopher. He has since passed away, but he is also in the book. I had the idea to tell him about my anthology idea, my idea of, if you had a book that, had a dual language format, so that there was the writing in African languages, but also translated into English for those of us who read English to be able to appreciate as well, then it would be a nice spur to others thinking about the importance of writing in African languages, and specifically as it relates to the kind of exploration of, linguistic and conceptual resources within indigenous African languages that would be relevant to doing something like philosophy. And so I was excited to tell him this idea, especially because he edited multiple anthologies in African philosophy. He's got one that I think is just called something like African Philosophy. Then he's got one called Postcolonial African Philosophy. So he had already done some really important work as far as editing anthologies of African philosophy. And so my bright idea was, I tell him about this. Maybe he gets interested, and maybe he doesn't. And then I get to feel happy because an idea I had inspired someone else. And so I told him about the idea. He seemed to think that it was interesting and potentially fruitful. And then he kind of just looked at me and said, yeah, why don't you do it? And, as I mentioned that in the acknowledgments, that he said something like that to me. And it's one of those just interesting moments where there's something you hadn't even thought about. In this case, I had not given any thought to the idea that this would be something that I could do, that I could edit this anthology. But I would say in that moment really kind of empowered me, right? Made me think about what I might be able to do in a way that I hadn't. And so I'm always grateful to him for that. And I think that it's something that is important in general, that we always, when interacting with younger scholars, give them big dreams and ambitions and let them know how much they can do. In any case, that's how I, came to the decision that, okay, I'll give this a try. And it was, it was a long process, after that, because the book came out in 2013. So that's about 8 years, since the initial idea really took hold. To make the story of its of what happened after that pretty short, I'd say that a major thing that I was also grateful for is that Kwasi Weredu, who said yes to being in the book, which was great. He's really a giant in African philosophy. He also happens to know about this series that SUNY Press was doing, Living Indigenous Philosophies. It's a series that I think is going to be focused especially on Indigenous American philosophy. And the first volume in the series before mine is about American Indian philosophy, as the title puts it. Nevertheless, it fit with their vision, the editors of the series, Ann Waters and Agnes Curry. It fit with their vision, to do a volume like mine. And I'm very glad for that as well. I think that, that everything has come together, pretty perfectly. And I'm really happy that the book is out and that people can enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, and, I would think, sort of along with that, another empowering endorsement would be that of Ngugi, right? Who, as you mentioned, to say the least, right? So who wrote the foreword, you could hardly get a better, more apposite, I think, author for the foreword, mm-hmm. to this project. And so can you sort of explain the importance of Ngugi to a project like this and to the larger project of Afrophone, writing?
Yes, sure. So, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, earlier in his career, he was known as James Ngugi. And so even in terms of the fact that we call him Ngugi wa Thiong'o now, right, is part of his important evolution, his desire that became very strong and very central to his career, that African people would value African languages. And so at a certain point, I want to say it's in the 1970s, I hope I'm not getting the history wrong there, he made the decision that he would stop writing in English. I think he at some point was thinking that it was going to be all of his work. But certainly, what he ends up deciding is that his creative work is no longer going to be in English, right? And he was a pioneering, East African author. He's from Kenya. So I think he may have been the first East African novelist in English. I'm not sure if I'm remembering that correctly. But so he was pioneering in English, but it became important to him to stop pioneering in English and to value African languages. He is of the Kikuyu people in Kenya, and so he now writes his creative work mainly in Kikuyu, and I'm very fortunate that Betty Wambui, one of the authors in the book, was able to contribute an essay in Kikuyu. So that's a nice connection between the book and Ngugi's decision only to write in African languages. Eben Mwangi is a literary theorist at Northwestern in the English department. He is the one who translates Betty Wambui's essay for the volume, right? So the volume, as I said, is a dual language format. You have the original essay on the left side, and then on the facing page on the right side is the English translation. And it was important to me that the translations be done by someone who was not the author, him or herself. Certainly all my authors could have, if they wanted to, translated their own piece into English. But I thought it was important that they concentrate on just writing something in, you know, their mother tongue, and then someone else would come along to translate it. So Eben Mwangi was the translator for Betty Wambui's essay, and he has written a lot on Ngugi. As I recall, it was through his kind of contact that we were able to make Ngugi know about the project, and Ngugi found it exciting, you know, from the first time that he heard about it. Eventually, I was able to get him the whole manuscript, and he wrote his wonderful little foreword. I'm really grateful for it. I'm humbled by it. You know, it's entitled "Foreword: A Historic First," and it's just three short paragraphs, but I mean, I can't imagine someone doing more to express the importance of the project than what he did in his foreword. There's a part at the end of the foreword where he starts comparing me to other diasporic intellectuals who have kind of somehow made some impact on Africa. And I would say that, yeah, one of the strangest moments I've had in life was reading that paragraph. I still remember he had sent me the foreword to look at, and I had been reading it aloud to my wife, you know, and just smiling because, you know, as I said, it was doing such a good job of expressing the importance of the project. And I got to that part, and even before I could get there, my eyes scanned to see these names: Garvey, Du Bois, Fanon, Rodney, and I couldn't actually read it. I had to pass the computer to my wife so that she could read out that last paragraph, because I couldn't fix my mouth to say the nice things that he was going to say about me in that paragraph. So I am so appreciative of his support for the project. I had the opportunity to meet with him after the book was already published, when I attended a conference in St. Louis. And you know, he's just a lovely person. So being around him in person was just as amazing. And And yeah, he's a champion for the book. I mean, he has, you know, obviously he gives lots of talks around the world, and in a number of those talks, he's spoken about what he sees as the importance of this book. And so I'm forever grateful to him.
Yeah, and the foreword really is is very impressive, and I think particularly when he talks, you know, in the paragraph that you had trouble continuing to read aloud, right, about the transformative impact of your work and the project. It's interesting because in another part you sort of talk about some of the economic considerations, I think, right, that make it not profitable for many other authors to make, you know, the quote, you know, movie turn. So it's an interesting set of things to contemplate his endorsement about that, but his unique position as as a luminary makes certain things more feasible for him than others, and I just kind of wondered if you could maybe situate the project in terms of the things that have to be weighed for Afrophone writing to sort of really take the next few steps.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. I mean, there are those who don't support the kind of efforts that Ngugi has made to encourage more writing in African languages. And then, you know, for some, you know, saying that they don't support it would be too strong, but more, there's many who just wonder about how realistic it is to kind of have this dream of more writing, both creative and more broadly intellectual writing in African languages, right? And so, right, one way that someone might make that claim is to say, well, it's easy enough for Ngugi. He's one of the most famous African authors who is alive. So, you know, yes, he can write in Kikuyu and someone will publish it and someone will translate it and it will make its way around the world that way. You know, what does that mean for others? And, you know, the pessimistic reading would be that, oh, well, so this means nothing for others, right? I think that the way that Ngugi might think about it, certainly the way that I would think about it, is not so much to call it his luxury, but more to call it his responsibility. That is to say, yes, he is fortunate to be in this position, right? And that makes it all the more important that he would use that prominent position to encourage this kind of anti-Eurocentric turn, right? This valuing of African languages as a mode in which we do our creative and intellectual work. So, you know, we could also say that this project is not likely to somehow make it the case that anyone who is doing African philosophy can kind of just start doing all of their work in their mother tongue and never have to worry about its circulation or its ability to get published. I mean, all of that would be unrealistic at this point, right? But it does seem to me that the point is to kind of get started, right? And, you know, who knows what the future holds? We would hope, for example, that the future holds for Africa economic transformations that will better enable traditions of African writing in African languages to be better supported, right? So obviously, as you said, there's economic considerations and some of those economic considerations, right, would make a difference, you know, if well, if African countries were richer than they are, right? To put it that way, right? And so there's, you know, there's the idea of hope for the future. Although I would say, what I would also say about what is now is that, let's say I was a philosopher from Africa, which of course I'm a philosopher of African descent, but I'm not a philosopher from Africa. I'm not actually someone whose mother tongue is an indigenous African language. But what I would like to think would be the case about myself if I were, is that first of all, I would be publishing in English, and I would be publishing in English, A, because it's the language that I was trained in, if we're making this a person who's relatively close to myself, in reality. And it's the case that for most of the philosophers in my anthology, they were trained in English. Bashir, who I mentioned earlier, would have been, of course, trained in French. also I would be, you know, happy to be writing in English because of the ways in which it, you know, a very broad audience is given to you if you're someone who can write in English. And I would, you know, make full use of that, right? But I would also, I would like to think, be looking for opportunities to strengthen my ability to write in my mother tongue. You know, and the difficulty of that is something worth emphasizing. That is to say, I think for those of us who have, say, English as a mother tongue, right, the fact is that our professional writing gets to be in the same language that we, you know, would say use talking to our parents, and that's something, you know, to take for granted. That we end up taking for granted because, you know, it's different. You might have this language that is so central to your home life, but it's actually not easy to write something in it that would be, for example, work in philosophy because of the fact that, again, you know, your training is in English. You know, you are used to, you know, getting into the mode of writing philosophy in English, right? Even though it's not your mother tongue. So it is my hope that I would, first of all, be, you know, even just on an individual basis, practicing my ability to express myself in this indigenous tongue. But then, you know, there are things sometimes like, newspapers, right? Or other, you know, outlets in African countries where there is some writing being done in some African languages, not all. certainly there's, you know, radio programs and other oral forms of communication, right, that one could participate in if possible. Where one would be able to express some of one's ideas in African languages, right? And so I guess the point I'm making is that now is the time to kind of use what outlets there is, even if, you know, we're still a ways off from, you know, the idea of a very flourishing publishing industry of intellectual and creative work in indigenous African languages.
Yeah, that makes me think of several things, right? I, you know, really intrigued by the point you just raised. Consistently working in the in a European idiom, right? Really broadly and really narrowly defined. That has some real implications for you know. Output, particularly scholarly output. And that's a really, that's something that's taken up in a number of the essays, right? Mm-hmm. Well, let me back up for a second, a couple of the themes that you raise sort of preemptively in the introduction, right, that run through the essays include this idea of African-European difference. You also mentioned deference to tradition and religiosity. Right. But sticking with the African-European difference for a moment, I think the first one where this is a central theme is the Ethiopian conception of time and modernity. Like you said, following on from the comments you made just now, this idea of really operating in two worlds, two frames of reference, alongside and having to, kind of work in tandem if you're a thinker, whose native, language is one thing, but most of your work is done in another. And I wonder if you would be able to talk about that. I find that chapter fascinating as well because of the,
it is fascinating.
For a lot of reasons, but, you also are dealing, with, non-Roman characters. Indigenous part of the chapter. So if you could kind of talk a little bit about that, that'd be great.
I think that it's nice that you just mentioned the fact that the second chapter by Mesai Kebede is in Amharic, and so what that even means is just as a point of what it's physically like to pick up this book, right, and to flip through it, right? I think that even that simple thing is I would hope indicative of the kind of change that the book is working towards, because to flip past that part of the book is to see, right? This very old script, right? The Ethiopic script used to write Amharic, and which was also used to write Ge'ez, the literary and liturgical language of Ethiopia before it. To see that and to see a contemporary philosopher using that language and that script to express his ideas, I think, is powerful. Certainly, if one can feel the power of that, one has some idea of why I, created this book. In any case, as far as kind of the content of that essay, right? So it's about conceptions of time. And it's also about the question of modernity, and so it brings up questions about kind of what an Ethiopian conception of time is, and he does interesting things there, thinking about the components of an Ethiopian conception of time, both in kind of certain like traditional agrarian aspects that kind of lead toward a certain circularity of time, but also the Christian tradition, which is millennia old in Ethiopia, which has a certain teleological or goal oriented conception of time as well. and what he eventually ends up talking about is what he views as a kind of loss or a kind of failure to hold to a particularly Ethiopian conception of temporality and of time and of history, because of certain Eurocentric turns or influences, especially in the 20th century, in, as he sees it. And so there's he's dealing there partly with, you know, an important question to thinking, especially about Ethiopia, almost more than anywhere else on the continent, which is to what extent did Ethiopia fail to achieve a distinctive form of modernity? There are many Ethiopian intellectuals who bring up the comparison to Japan, and I think that comparison does come up in that chapter as well, right?
Yep.
With Japan being kind of this emblem of a non-Western country, a non-European or European-derived nation that managed to modernize, that managed to become modern, but not through colonialism, not through you know, taking on all of what Western modernity is, right? Rather, having its own distinctive path to modernity, and so there's a sense that many people have that, you know, that Ethiopia failed to achieve that. Right, and so that's one of the kind of historical issues that's at work in his chapter. Right, I mean, another thing that I would say is fascinating about that chapter is the importance that he gives to the Kebra Nagest, which is almost like a holy book. Certainly, you know, a book that is extremely important to the Ethiopian Orthodox tradition. And he thinks that book expresses a kind of Ethiopian-centered conception of time and history, which is important. And so he's aiming to recover that in some ways. It's interesting. I mean, I will say that there was an anonymous reviewer, you know, when the book was going through, review by the press, who I think, you know, maybe seemed a bit even offended by the chapter, right? Maybe thinking of it as kind of involving a certain kind of Ethiopian chauvinism, I leave it to readers of that chapter to see what they think, whether they think it's chauvinist or something of that sort. Certainly, what I would like to think is that for those readers who do end up feeling that they think that there's something distastefully kind of chauvinist about it, that they would appreciate kind of what it is to have a book in which you could have something like Ethiopian chauvinism. We certainly get enough chauvinism in the European varieties, right? Let's have some African kinds, please. and I think that, I think it's a very powerful chapter, and that Kebede is just a really interesting thinker.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a really interesting thought, right? So equal opportunity chauvinism, why not? Well, and again, in that vein, I think that this idea of say the Japan example of, you know, achieving modernity on its own terms, let's say, is really interesting, and this chapter, to me, related as well to the second second Luo essay What's in a Name, right? That really kind of goes through this kind of taxonomy or scheme of naming conventions among the Luo people, and which has the essay has a very explicit cultural preservation objective. I mean, that's sort of stated at the outset. And it's sort of this theme, the theme is the guinea fowl should not discard its feathers. And so kind of, taking that along with, you know, sort of allegations of chauvinism. Just wondering if you could talk about that aspect of the collection, because the collection seems in some ways to be very, very anthropological, right? In some ways, and sort of connecting it to sort of broader systems of thought, is something that, I guess I'm wondering if you could sort of, help us do that sort of,
And it's interesting, you know, that you mentioned that proverb, getting fast, not discarded sputters, which, if I remember correctly, also comes up in the chapter before it, which focuses on proverbs generally, right? And so I have in the anthology two essays in Luo, one by D.A. Masolo and the other by Frederick Ochieng Odhiambo. And I think that's nice. I think that, you know, that being able to see two different authors writing in the same language enriches the book, and then there end up being these interesting convergences, you know, some of which, you know, could even be influenced by the fact that, well, you know, like these two are friends in real life. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, more generally, there's certain common influences on them as Luo philosophers, including, you know, the common influence of proverbs. I think that it's probably hard to overestimate the importance of proverbs as an aspect of tradition which shapes kind of intellectual thought, right? You know, it's the kinds of things that you are told in proverbs as a child, right? Especially given the fact that proverbs themselves involve often some thought to kind of make sense of what's even being said, right? As I say, I think it's hard to overestimate the importance of that to someone developing a philosophical mind, right? Developing ways of interpreting the world, right, and interpreting language. In any case, so I just wanted to say that it's kind of cool when you see connections like that between those chapters, and so, you know, to speak of the ways in which the book can be sometimes kind of anthropological. Certainly, that chapter, the one by Ochieng Odhiambo on naming. That word is more appropriate to that chapter than any other, or you know, it's most appropriate to that chapter. Like given that, right, there's you know, even parts where of the chapter where it's long lists of of names and their meanings, right? And that is I think important work, and I'll make a point here that I make in the introduction in African philosophy, one of the controversies that there has been in the field is about the value of what gets labeled ethnophilosophy. And the term was used as a kind of criticism, especially by a philosopher from Benin, Paulin Ntondji. It was used as a term of criticism for work that, you know, was calling itself philosophical, but was perhaps merely ethnological, reporting on, the kinds of things that an ethnologist would report on, and ascribing that somehow as the philosophical production of the people as a whole, right? Mm-hmm. So among the controversies about this would be even the idea that does a people do, or can a people do philosophy, or is it not the case, right, that philosophy is a kind of critical enterprise that only an individual can engage in. Yes, in conversation with others, of course, but a philosophical thought being something that, you know, that a person produces and that another person can think about and criticize, rather than it being possible for a people to produce philosophy. So there are these various criticisms of what's called ethnophilosophy, right? But one thing that Ntuanji was criticizing was what he called the extraversion of African philosophy in an ethno-philosophical vein. And what he meant was that there was a kind of way in which those who had gone to Europe or wherever and had been trained in philosophy, and who were now trying to write about, you know, the Yoruba conception of this or the Zulu conception of that, right? We're kind of setting themselves up as spokespersons who could kind of prove to Europeans that, hey, we've got interesting philosophical things too, right? And so, you know, that this was, you know, a way of he ends up in some of his work kind of comparing it to, you know, the underdevelopment of Africa in terms of, you know, the extraversion of resources, right? The extraction of resources by Europe. So part of what's important about this book is that even if one wants to say that in some senses of the term, much of the work, and especially a chapter like the one I'm naming, if one wants to say that it is ethno-philosophical, right, it is important that it is not ethno-philosophical in an extroverted sense, right? It is precisely not a case of running off to tell Europeans, hey, look what we have, because the very format, the writing in indigenous African languages, means that these are African philosophers speaking first and foremost to African audiences. And so I think that that's an important aspect of the project. And I will note here, I don't note it in the book, but Ntuanji himself began work on an essay in Gun, I think is maybe how you pronounce it, G-U-N, or also maybe Gunbe, if you add the G-B-E at the end. In any case, his own indigenous tongue from Benin, he began work on an essay for this volume, and he's a very busy man and things kind of intervened, and so I wasn't able to get his piece for this volume. And I didn't want to tantalize readers by mentioning that in the volume, but I mention it here because I think it's kind of you know, relevant to the trajectory of African philosophy. So at one time, you know, Ntuanji's concern was to criticize the various failings that he found in ethno-philosophy. But if you follow his work, you see how appreciation for indigenous conceptual resources is something that is very important to him as well. And he was supportive of this project, right? He was interested in participating in it, and I'd like to think that, you know, if there's another edition down the line, that perhaps it could be expanded and that he could be in that one. So I'd like to think that African philosophy is moving towards a place where the importance of drawing on African traditions is kind of almost taken for granted, that we would have moved past some of the controversies over whether, for example, if you try and draw on African traditions, you're going to end up with this weird thing that's either anthropology or that's not anthropology, not philosophy, but some weird, you know, hybrid between the two, and whether that's problematic. I'd like to think that African philosophy is moving toward the place where there's an understanding that for African philosophy to flourish and be successful, it must be drawing on traditional African culture, from the Proverbs to, you know, things like the religious traditions. I'm thinking, for example, of the importance of work on the tradition, on the Ifa divination system in Yoruba. I think that's the future of African philosophy really does involve continuous drawing on the African path.
Well, and the sort of reiterate, like I said, you do mention in the introduction that the sort of deference to tradition is something that runs throughout the essays, or arguably runs throughout the essays. And I do, if you could, just to follow on with comments made just now, in the Word and Mind chapter written in Igbo, there's a distinction made between Igbo philosophy and the study of philosophy in the Igbo language. And yeah. I'm wondering if you can, like I said, you know, this is, I think, would be a nice coda to the comments you just made, if you could kind of outline this distinction and its centrality to the project of the anthology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and that chapter is written by Emmanuel Eze, who, as I mentioned, kind of in a way inspired the volume by telling me to go ahead and do it myself. Before I say a little more about that, you're right that I talk in the introduction about the idea of deference to tradition, right? And how there's something very appropriate about the way that one gets that feeling reading the book, because the very decision to write in an African language is already to kind of in a certain way defer to the importance of African tradition. I remember someone reading the final chapter of the book, which is in Akan or Chui, and it's by Kwasi Uredu, and this young woman who was able to read Chui, she said to me that, you know, it's like reading it is like, you know, hearing, you know, my grandfather or some elder, you know, talk to me about, you know, the need for, you know, tradition and this, that, and the other. It gave her this kind of village elder vibe, so to speak. And I thought that was so interesting, partly because Weredu himself, as someone who has written most of his philosophical work in English, right, often comes across as someone who is not very much into deferring to tradition, or rather, there's certain, if you look at some of his early work, like he even has this famous essay called something like I wanted to call it How Not to Do African Philosophy, but I think that it's not called that. It's like how not to think about African tradition or something like that. I'm sad that I'm forgetting the title, but some of his early work is really about not being overly invested in tradition, and he criticizes certain things like libations and various things, and there's a certain kind of, let's say, modernizing impulse in some of his work, and he is someone who remains, Like Ntonji, to whatever extent, you know, their early work was kind of questioning African philosophy's obsession with African tradition, right? Like, both of them count as people who have since been more demonstrating the need for a connection between African tradition and modern African philosophy. But to know that someone who has in some ways been so critical of tradition at various times in his work was coming off as the village elder, right? Was, I think, to me, one of the interesting questions of voice, right? In terms of what it means for someone who usually writes in English to now write in this mother tongue, right? How do they end up sounding different? And I thought that was very interesting. But as a usefully reflects, right, on the distinction between, you know, the study of philosophy in the Igbo language and Igbo philosophy. He says, for example, any Igbo can be a thinker, but not every philosophy created by an Igbo thinker can be said to be a part of the philosophy of the Igbo people. Right. And he also says any philosopher that understands the Igbo language knows that he or she may learn philosophy in the Igbo language, but what he or she discovers may not necessarily be philosophy about the Igbo culture. Right. And he makes a number of distinctions of that sort. And I think that's right and important. So, it's going to make sense to talk about something like Igbo philosophy as in some way being connected to Igbo culture. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I mean, you know, there's something, you know, kind of radical about him making the point that you know, anyone can learn philosophy in Igbo, but not necessarily be learning Igbo philosophy, right? And you know, someone may even miss what I think is a bit radical about that, which is the fact that right now, you know, people don't generally learn philosophy in Igbo, or certainly, I would say actually that people learn lots of philosophical stuff in Igbo all the time. But what I mean is that in terms of understanding philosophy as a discipline, mm-hmm. right, then we can say that pretty much no one ever, like that is to say someone, you know, going to university in Igbo land, you know, would be learning philosophy in English.
And so,
I think that is kind of symbolic of how deeply rooted the cultural transformation that this book is about, you know, what a fundamental level that cultural transformation is on. That is to say, there's the idea of, like, you could even try and teach, your Descartes or your Aristotle or your kind of, other various products of the Western philosophical tradition. You could teach that in Igbo or another African language. And that's already something that is not very common for people who speak indigenous African languages to get the chance to learn about Western philosophy in their own language, mm-hmm. right? You know, and so, in a certain sense, one could even ask what's more important, to start teaching in the language or to use it to describe, you know, the culture. And I mean, certainly we're at the stage where what is possible and what needs to be done is, you know, philosophy rooted in the cultures of Africa, whether that philosophy is written in English or in indigenous African languages or in French or German or Italian and so on. But, you know, I think that this book points toward a future time in which you know, it will not be weird for someone to learn philosophy, world philosophy, in Igbo, and also then produce philosophical work rooted in the Igbo culture in Igbo.
Well, that I think brings us really nicely to the chapter written by Betty Wambui, because it is precisely described this kind of on the cusp of using the language to describe the culture, but also opening the way to writing philosophy steeped in the culture. And this is an interesting chapter for many reasons. As you note, women are severely underrepresented within African philosophy. Mm-hmm. And the essay is kind of devoted to unpacking the claim that, and I quote, among the Kikuyu people of central Kenya, women, children, goats, and land are regarded as one and the same. And mm-hmm. she, you know, she takes some nice time and space to sort of, mm-hmm. you know, create the sort of cultural backdrop to that yeah. claim and then kind of troubles it in a number of ways. And I'm just wondering if you can sort of talk about that.
Yeah. It's a very important chapter in the book, as you say, for many of the reasons you already stated. I had trouble with the problem of the underrepresentation of women in African philosophy. There are a lot of philosophers, a lot of African philosophers who I approached about being in the project, you know, who turned me down and turned me down for understandable reasons. And sometimes it was, well, you know what? It wasn't often because they were too busy, right? And anyone who turned me down because they were too busy, I mean, like, should have realized it's going to take me 8 years. So, you know, yeah, you have time. But I mean, you know, really, when I was turned down, it was often because of something that I was mentioning earlier. Like, this is a real challenge. This was hard for a number of the authors in the book, in a way that, you know, even myself, I can't fully understand. I can only kind of, you know, intellectually grasp it. But it you know, it was hard to write in these languages, when you're used to doing your professional work in English or French, for the people of this volume. And so I go back to that because, you know, this meant that some of the women philosophers, that I approached, right, you know, declined for that reason, the same reason that other, male philosophers declined. But it became, you know, this kind of really tough thing for me because, you know, like certain male philosophers declining, you know, wasn't catastrophic, I guess is maybe the word I would use, in the way that I was finding it catastrophic to be turned down, by women philosophers because I really was not going to be okay with publishing the volume and it being nothing but men, right? And that was something that I, you know, that I really had to work to avoid. And so I'm so grateful to Betty Wambui for her chapter. And I thought it was just brilliant that, you know, that not only would there be, you know, a chapter in the book by a woman, but that it would be a really interesting work in philosophy of gender, because that's what it is. You know, it is a philosophical exploration of gender. And so you mentioned what the chapter is about. So just to explain that a little bit more, she describes having been in a conversation with a friend. Right. And the friend remarks that women, children, goats, and land are regarded as one and the same thing. right? And the friend means, you know, in by the Gikuyu, right? And so this really struck her, and she wanted to know, you know, what that could mean. And so she looks to what can be reconstructed of Gikuyu tradition, right, to understand in what ways were, you know, girls and boys differentiated, even in terms of, you know, she talks about a disparity in the ululations uttered in celebration of an infant's arrival, right? Three ululations for a girl and five for a boy, right? And so kind of starting from birth, right? She's interested in what are the things, you know, where girls and boys are being differentiated, and what are the implications of those differentiations, right? And so some of what she, you know, discusses, maybe points in the direction of validating, right, her friend's claim, right? But at the same time, then there's a lot that she's also finding, right, about Gikuyu tradition that points in a different direction, that at least points into can't remember exactly the word she used, but kind of like holes in the system, right? And holes in the system, you know, like systematically, you know, holes that are systematically there, right? She talks about interesting things like women who were marrying other women, and she talks about women who chose not to get married and who could choose this on the basis of taking a certain path. And so these gaps and spaces, as it's described at some point, right, troubles, you know, too quick, you know, a judgment about what gender meant in Gikuyu tradition. But you know, it, the ending of that chapter is kind of interesting, because she's concerned to kind of have us fully appreciate the ways in which the tradition exceeds a kind of simplistic description of gender inequality, and yet she remains also very concerned to not allow the forms of gender inequality in the tradition to somehow then go unseen or then be kind of just kind of ignored, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, I remember, you know, discussing with her back and forth whether she was being too ambivalent at the end, but she, you know, she knew how she wanted to end the chapter, and she knew, and I think that's powerful, right? Like my editorial desire to see the chapter end less ambivalently, mm-hmm. you know, it's perhaps important that was superseded by her, you know, right, as author, to end with ambivalence.
Right. That's very, very, very interesting. And we have taken up a lot of your time, but this has been a really fascinating conversation, and I've really enjoyed it because I really enjoyed reading what I could of the anthology, and think it's a really fantastic project. Nice. I'm wondering if you'd be able to tell us what you're currently working on.
Yes. Well, working on a number of different things. To think first of something that would be kind of relevant to the topic of African studies in particular. As I mentioned to you before the interview, I will be at the African Studies Association conference in San Diego next month, which you will also be at. I'll be on a panel about doing the history of African philosophy. And my paper on that panel will be about ancient Egyptian thought. So I have a deep interest in ancient Egyptian thought, and I've already published one piece, Embodying Justice in Ancient Egypt, The Tale of the Eloquent Peasant as a Classic of Political Philosophy. Published that in 2013 in the British Journal for the History of Philosophy. And so I will be exploring some other important works in ancient Egyptian thought, The Instruction of Ptahotep and The Instruction of Amenemope, and looking at silence as a virtue. Silence as a virtue is the title of the paper. I think the subtitle is something like A Study in the History of Ancient African Philosophy. I'm looking at how these texts that I'm looking at are part of a tradition in ancient Egypt of moral and political philosophy, and how silence was understood to be a certain kind of virtue, and the kinds of arguments in these texts for silence as a virtue. And so I think that work is interesting, and I'm going to go ahead and admit, in case anyone gets the wrong idea, that I unfortunately do not read ancient Egyptian, just like I don't read any of the African languages in listening to ourselves. I mean, I will say that being editor and the various things that I needed to do as editor, I learned a little bit of each language to some extent. Certainly words here and there as I worked with the translators, and in some cases with the authors. I would be a better scholar of all these things if I somehow spoke all these languages. But as it turns out, I can't wait until I actually have all that mastery, to do some of this work. That's an interesting thing I'm doing. As far as book projects, I'm involved, in two book projects, at the moment. I'm involved in multiple book projects, some of which will be also things that I'm editing, just as in this case. But for purposes of time, I'll just mention two projects where I'm not serving as editor. There's a book that I will be a co-author of called Four Views on Race. So Philosophy of Race is a major interest of mine, and I will be co-authoring a book with Sally Haslanger, Quayshawn Spencer, and Joshua Glasgow, all three of whom are important philosophers in the area of philosophy of race, where we will be representing different views on what race is, and after initial chapters explaining our own view, then we'll get a chapter where we get to react to everybody else. So the book is going to be a kind of interesting debate. And so I'm excited about that. And I am currently in the process of writing up a book proposal for what will be my first single-authored book, which will be a book about W.E.B. Du Bois. The famous African-American sociologist, historian, activist, etc., happens also to be my favorite philosopher. So I've been given an opportunity. I won't say the press yet, just because I want to make sure I actually get the proposal accepted. But I've been given an opportunity to write a book on Du Bois, and it would be the first book that is kind of, an introduction to his work from a philosophical perspective. And so I'm really excited about that. Like I said, I've also got some other things on the go, some other things I'm editing, but I won't take up time by mentioning those, and I'll just say for people to keep an eye out for me, because I'll be around.
Okay, good. Well, all of that sounds really, really, really exciting. The Du Bois project sounds incredibly exciting. So
yeah, I'm very excited about it.
We'll definitely be sure to follow up with you about that. Professor Jeffers, I really want to thank you again for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it as well. Thank you for this podcast.
Good, good. Well, glad that you enjoy it. And for the others listening to the podcast today, joining me has been Professor T.K. Jeffers, currently Associate Professor in the Department of Philosophy at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.